Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. What do you do? It's one of those standard questions we ask to make conversation, to be polite, or to get to know each other. For Ashley Javanet, this question can get tricky. She's a neuroscientist who does animal experiments.
There was one time I had a very chatty Lyft driver who, we started talking. I was like, oh, yeah, I study the brain and trying to understand how, you know, different cell types talk to each other. And, you know, he kind of got really curious and he was like, oh, well, how do you do that? And I tried to explain, like, I do it in mice. And he was like, wait, what? Like, you do this in mice? Like, that's so weird. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, you can't do it in humans. And that would be even weirder, I think. Like, he kind of got fixated on the fact that it was happening in, like, mice and rats and was not very happy about it.
Mice end up being killed in Ashley's lab, but she feels that this kind of work is important.
We have medicine and amazing treatments because of all of the animal research we've done.
Think antibiotics, insulin, cancer treatments, vaccines. Lab animals give us insights. They allow us to understand diseases and find cures. But this kind of research is also something we don't really like to think about or talk about. It's sort of an uncomfortable topic, right? On today's episode, we'll explore what we can learn from experimenting on animals and how we treat them in the process.
They've taught us an awful lot about fundamentals of biology and now more than ever relevant to human disease.
The more animals that I had to kill, the more I realized that this was pretty much all for nothing.
She would take about 5 or 10 steps out the door and then she would just sort of stall.
They're about the size of a tip of a pin.
So small.
And you can see other ones where the polyps are retracted. It doesn't mean that they're like dead.
So you can start at the single cell level, observe them under a scope.
It's finding a way to ensure that we respect the animals.
So let's get back to Ashley Javanet, who was having that conversation with her Lyft driver. She studies the neurons and circuits in the brain that allow us to see the world. She does that work in mice, and she feels for the animals she uses in her lab. Ashley told us working with mice has been a real learning curve, even something as simple as picking them up.
You know, a lot of people will pick them up by the tail. It might be better actually to kind of scoop them up with two hands, although some of them, especially when they're first being handled, are a bit scared and they might bite you if you do that, so you have to be a bit careful. They kind of like stay to the outside of the cage, or they'll often try to run under the bedding, you know, to try to like hide. Yeah, it definitely takes like maybe up to 10 minutes like the first time, you know, and then maybe 5, and you eventually start to sort of predict their behavior as they're moving around so you can do it much faster. Yeah, now it takes me like maybe 10 seconds. Actually, my first summer of research, I did research with rats that summer. Yeah, I remember sort of there was a couple of rats that were like really docile and nice. And so I was like, oh, you know, like these are the good rats. And yeah, so it can be tough at the end of that to say goodbye. You know, fortunately, we can't take like all of the animals home with us at the end of the day. And it can be expensive to keep them around. So I think that's, you know, the main reason why most labs will euthanize them at the end. So you put the rat into the CO2 chamber, and after a few minutes, they're unconscious, and their bodily function ceases, and so then, yeah, it's done. It can be startling to people who haven't really thought about, you know, how we know what we know, or how we know that medicines work, and things like that, and a lot of people can, like, you know, go through life without thinking about the nitty-gritty, because they're not doing the research. Yeah, there's a lot of people out there who don't believe that any type of animal research should be happening. And I used to see those people when I worked at the Salk Institute, actually. But a lot of times the protesters will find old pictures and kind of like severe looking pictures of like monkeys that are like fixed in a setup and they can't move. This type of research has gotten much better, so, and we've learned so much more about, you know, how we can do these experiments in a way that really is ethical. So I think sometimes I avoid those conversations because of fear, right? Because I fear a backlash from someone like against me for the type of research that I'm doing. As a result, you feel like you need to keep what you're doing, you know, a little bit like close to you. And like, I often won't explain things to friends or family because it feels like it's a bit, you know, like too much for them to handle or something.
Good morning, Sherlock.
I have a rabbit Liz. Currently. I've had the rabbit for about 4 years.
Oh, yeah. It's good old cilantro breakfast.
His name is Sherlock, and he's named as such because he has black floppy ears. Yeah, he's kind of big, actually. He's maybe like 5 pounds, maybe a little bit more than that. I've spent a lot of time with Sherlock, and I sort of like feel like I understand him as a creature. I think it would be really hard for me to do research on rabbits. He drove across the country with me in the front seat from San Diego to New York. You know, there's all these like kind of life things that Sherlock has been with me for. If I had a mouse with me through all those things, I probably would feel the same way about that mouse maybe in the end. But of course, a lot of this is very socially constructed. We don't keep squirrels as pets, for example, even though, you know, if we did domesticate squirrels, they might be just as friendly as a rabbit. You know, there's sort of that practical side that, you know, once we've decided, okay, you know, mice, you know, they may not have exactly the same level of consciousness as a human, and we, you know, have decided that they are a creature that we can do this on, then you kind of move forward as a field and keep working with them. I think that we should have conversations about, you know, what's best for animals and how we can treat animals better in the lab. But I do think, like, the consensus is that we should do this.
That's Ashley Javanet. She is a neuroscientist at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. Alan Yu produced this piece, and he's here now to talk more about this topic. And Alan, like Ashley, a lot of researchers are thinking about how to treat lab animals better, right?
Right, so partly it's because they love animals and so they want to treat the animals well, but they also say treating the animals well leads to better science.
How so?
So it works by trying to remove some of the stress that could impact the results of your study. So I spoke to 2 veterinarians who told me that if we treat the mice and rats that we use well, like they're in their natural environments, they'll be less stressed.
Natural environments, I mean, when I'm thinking about a lab and mice and rats in a lab, I'm thinking of little cages with mice in them and nothing else. So what are they envisioning?
Right, so it's something quite different. So one of the people I spoke to, Tara Martin, she's a veterinarian at the University of Michigan. She takes care to make the mice feel at home in their cages so that when they're not being used for experiments, they can do normal mouse things.
Mice really like to build these complex nests out of multiple kinds of material.
So the researchers put bits of crinkled paper and cotton in the cage that mice can use for their nests. And mice also don't want to wait to be fed by humans, so Tara told me that the researchers can make that more fun for them.
Some things we can do are get little bits of treats or food that we can crumble up and mix into the bedding, or perhaps sunflower seeds, things like that, that we can sprinkle into their regular food. And what they will do is kind of dig around and look for those bits.
So that sounds kind of like occupational therapy for mice.
Right, and that's important because when the mice live in these standard empty boxes with nothing to do except try out drugs, they get bored.
Any animal that lives in a barren environment is a pretty stressed animal. It can affect hormones within their body. It can affect their immune system. It can certainly affect brain development. And when you have all of those effects, they all can act as confounds on your research, or they can alter the results of your research.
So scientists used to think that all they had to do was keep the animals healthy and clean. But now it's standard practice to provide the animals with less boring and more happy environments.
All right, but how do they know if this is actually working? So how do you tell if a mouse is happy now?
So that's part of the research as well. One of the other people I spoke to is Jennifer Lofgren, and she's in charge of animal welfare and compliance at the drug company Novartis.
Mice that aren't feeling well aren't going to build a good nest. So looking at the cage, I would know that it was a very happy mouse inside if it was well organized and there was a big fluffy nest.
So Alan, is this common for researchers to go the distance to make sure the mice and rats are happy and have a nice place?
So it should be very common because it's now required of animal research in the US to provide these what's called enriched environments.
But I guess enriched environments could be anything from some tissue paper in a cage to a really fun setup that's almost like an amusement park for mice.
Right. The researchers are supposed to do their best. I guess if they want to put in the extra effort, then yes, they could build an amusement park for their mice.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks, Maiken.
We're talking about animals in labs, what we can learn from experimenting on them, and how we treat them. Animal research has been going on for centuries, and for a long time in this country, there really were no regulations. So many scientists did pretty much whatever they thought would bring new insights, and that sometimes led to a lot of suffering for the animals. Michael Udell is a science history enthusiast, and he has one such example, the story of Tusco the elephant.
In 1962, psychiatrists at the University of Oklahoma School of Medicine thought it would be a good idea to get Tusco high on lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as LSD. Publishing their study in the journal Science, psychiatrists Lewis West and Chester Pierce noted that because of his remarkable intelligence, his extended lifespan, his capacity for highly organized group relationships, and his extraordinary psychobiology in general, there is now a growing interest in this animal on the part of psychiatrists. The experiment sought to artificially induce a condition found only in elephants called must, M-U-S-T-H. Must occurs generally once or twice per year in males beginning in early adulthood. An elephant beginning a period of must is restless and irritable. His eyes water, and a brown and sticky fluid is excreted from his temporal glands, which are located midway between his eye and ear. Now that's just the beginning. Within a few days, elephants go berserk, as Western Pierce called it, becoming violent all around them, including other elephants and zookeepers. In order to understand must, Weston Pierce thought the best way to mimic or induce it was to get an elephant at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Oklahoma City, in this case our friend Tusco, high on LSD. Tusco did not fare well. They overdosed him. And after a few minutes, poor Tusco trumpeted loudly, collapsed, and died from a seizure. What did these scientists learn from this bizarre experiment? They wrote, "It appears that the elephant is highly sensitive to the effects of LSD, a finding which may prove valuable in elephant control work."
That's Michael Udell remembering Tusco the elephant. Michael hosts a monthly improv night that's about science. His day job is professor of public health at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Tusco died decades ago, but many people argue that lab animals still die and suffer for no good reason. One of them is Emily Trunnell. She is a neuroscientist who works for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Emily told me that when she was getting her PhD, she got more and more disgusted with her work.
I went into neuroscience, not really understanding that the use of animals was so ubiquitous. So I was planning out my very first project with my major professor, and we were talking about what I would be doing, and you know, he pretty much told me that I should be doing experiments on animals because that's what journals want to publish. So as I was going along and doing these experiments, I was using mostly rats, some mice, and I was doing experiments feeding them different diets and seeing how it affected their brain. And the more animals that I had to kill, the more I realized that this was pretty much all for nothing. None of the data that we were gathering really was contributing to science, and yet I would continue to do experiments, continue to kill animals, and it all seemed like it was just to get me my degree.
When you say it wasn't contributing to science, what do you mean? Because
a lot comes out of these experiments. I mean, every time I take an antibiotic or every time I take something else, I probably owe this to research that was done on animals.
Well, there have been successes in science, but what you're missing there is that 95% of the drugs that are tested in animals, they're safe and they're effective in animals. They go into human clinical trials and they're not safe, they're not effective, and that represents a huge waste of time and money that animal experiments didn't predict what would happen in humans. And that's NIH's own statistic.
The dog you just heard in the background, that's Emily's rescue mutt named Ella Bean. What could scientists do instead of animal research?
So if we really want to find a cure for diseases like cancer or diabetes or stroke, we need to be investing in methods that rely on human physiology and human genetics. And there are lots of examples of these now. One is the organ on a chip, and these chips, they're small microfluidic devices. They're about the size of a computer memory stick, and they're lined with human cells. And you can create three-dimensional physiological human environments in these small devices. So recently, an antibody therapy was tested in their blood vessel on a chip. And this was a therapy that was tested safely in animals, and in the early 2000s and late 90s, when it went to human clinical trials, humans developed blood clots and the trials had to be stopped. This was not predicted by animal experiments, but when tested on this chip, it predicted this exact reaction.
A lot of scientists say they are doing better in terms of treating their lab animals and they provide nicer habitats for them. Do you feel like scientists are doing better, or in your mind, is that not good enough?
It's not good enough. You know, providing an animal who's being kept in a cage outside of their natural environment, being subjected to various diseases, pokes and prods for their entire life, I mean, providing them with an extra thing to chew on, I don't think that really gets you very far. Because I think scientists, especially young scientists, don't really want to use animals. And so the quicker we can fund these human relevant methods, you know, the quicker they can move on to those.
Emily Trunnell is a research associate for the animal rights advocacy organization PETA. PhD student Alexis Weinig goes to great lengths to treat her lab animals right. They are a type of coral, Lophelia pertusa.
Lophelia is kind of like the lab rat of deep sea corals, because there's labs all over the world that are using this coral to run experiments with, because it can be found in oceans all over the world. They are normally found at really cold temperatures, and so that's one of the biggest things, is that our lab has had to develop a way to keep them at 8 degrees Celsius, which is about 45 Fahrenheit. So we have these big chiller systems, and we have rooms that stay at that temperature in order to keep them happy. We also have to make our own seawater, since we're not by the ocean in Philadelphia. So we have to make seawater continuously and then do water changes in the big aquariums that we have to keep them in clean water. It's like having clean air for us. They need to have not a lot of debris in the water. We also have to feed them every day. So it's kind of like having a pet.
That's Alexis Weinig. She studies the impact of climate change and pollution on corals. So in the end, the Lophelia she's worked so hard to keep alive, they die. But the work Alexis is doing could save other corals during an oil spill. Researchers always have to weigh the benefits and harms when they are doing this kind of work. And one of the people helping scientists think through these experiments is bioethicist Nita Farahani. Nita told me that the only federal law that guides animal research in the U.S. is the Animal Welfare Act. But it only covers certain species, like dogs, cats, primates, or rabbits. The vast majority of animals used in labs, mice, rats, fish, or birds, they're not covered. In looking at different lab animals, have we given special protections to animals that we like better? You know, we like dogs, we like cats. Right.
I have a mouse trap in my house, you know, that
right.
that snaps shut and the mouse is dead.
Right.
Because I think of them more as an intruder. So
yeah. Well, I mean, we certainly, I don't know if it's just that we like them better, as I think the more properties of human-like behavior that we ascribe to animals, the more likely we are to give them greater protection. So for example, if you think about chimpanzees, you know, we have special concern for their psychological well-being, recognizing that they're much closer to us in terms of their experiences, in terms of their cognition, their ability to think and feel and experience life than a cockroach, maybe, for example. And so we, you know, the closer it gets to us, the more protections we provide. You know, it's complicated. It's based on our set of assumptions about what makes quality of life.
Are there people in the scientific community who say we should absolutely include mice and rats and give them better protections, and birds too?
Yeah, there are definitely lots of people who would like to expand the, you know, kinds of animals that are included. And then there are others who think we do far too much already. I mean, interestingly, there has been a big push in the past year that was spearheaded in part by the American medical colleges to try to call for decreased oversights. For example, researchers have to find if there's some, you know, less painful or less intrusive way of doing research on an animal, and they have to document that they've searched the literature and looked for kind of the least intrusive way. And they argue that that's too cumbersome, too difficult for researchers to comply with. And so you have really a push and pull in both directions. You have animal welfare activists and ethicists who say, hey, you know, we should expand the protections and expand the coverage for animals. And then on the other side, you have researchers saying, look, the kinds of oversight that's required, the kinds of inspections, the kinds of licensing, the kinds of paperwork that are required to engage in animal research are so cumbersome that we need to figure out a way to decrease the burden. And you see Congress making a similar call to do so to the existing agencies that oversee animal research.
In your opinion, what do we have to keep in mind as we think about which way we should go with this? You know, less animal research, more oversight, less oversight?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, we have to consider how we can ensure progress in science while minimizing discomfort, distress, and pain in animals. You know, I think the way you have that conversation is by trying to really get to a place of some agreement. We have to test out drugs, for example. We have to model certain kinds of diseases. The only way that we can alleviate a tremendous amount of suffering, not just in humans, but also in animals. The people who object the strongest are the most important part of the conversation, because ultimately, you have to bring those people as well as everybody else along for figuring out together what we're comfortable with as a society to enable scientific progress.
That's Nita Farahani. She's a bioethicist and a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. Because of some of the issues that Nita and I were just talking about, chimpanzees were phased out as lab animals in the U.S. starting about 5 years ago. And the chimps were supposed to head off to retirement. But where? Many have nowhere to go and are sort of stuck in limbo. Eilish O'Neill brings us the story of a few chimps who've been lucky enough to find a good retirement home.
The Cleelum Chimp Sanctuary is just off a lightly traveled desert highway in central Washington state. The first thing I have to do is sign the paperwork saying that if I die, I won't sue the sanctuary. I'm not too worried. Diana Goodrich takes me into a small observation room. On the other side of the bars, seven chimps are playing. One of the chimps, Jamie, comes over to us right away and starts staring intently at my feet.
She wants to see your shoes. Oh. Shoes.
Apparently, it's a thing. Jamie likes shoes. I pull up my pant leg so she can see my gray and black boots, and she nods her head vigorously.
That's a lot of approval right there. You're in. Good thing I wore boots. Yeah.
Diana and her partner, JB Mulcahy, live right here, just a few feet from the chimpanzees. They co-direct the sanctuary, and it's their life. JB tells me trying to figure out what the chimps want is what they do. Sometimes it's serving a smoothie through a giant straw. Other times, it's showing off your boots. I'm wearing my boots, but I guess I'm not so in, because a couple of minutes after I arrive, JB pushes me fast out the door. Jamie just threw some poop at us. JB says that's her way of hazing newcomers.
I think I blocked it with one little piece that it hit me bad.
JB hands me some paper towels so I can clean off my bag. This control the chimps have over their caretakers and environment is really different from their former life. JB and Diana say before coming to the sanctuary in 2008, the animals lived in a windowless basement in a biomedical research facility in Pennsylvania.
It is still legal to keep a chimpanzee in a 5-foot by 5-foot by 7-foot cage. Many of the chimps that live here, as far as we know, may have never seen the sun or stepped foot on grass in their entire lives.
The sanctuary doesn't have detailed records on their chimps' past lives, but JB says when the animals first arrived, they seemed hesitant to venture out and explore the hill behind the building.
Jamie would be out there and she'd be trying to get her friend Foxy to join her. And so Foxy would, she would take about 5 or 10 steps out the door and then she would just sort of stall. And then she would turn around and then she would try again and she couldn't quite do it. And then Jamie would actually come back and throw her arm around Foxy's waist and walk with her side by side. And that's what really got Foxy to work up the courage to go further.
In the 1980s, scientists hoped chimps would help them find an HIV vaccine. Researchers bred more than 1,000 of them. But it turns out, chimps don't develop AIDS the way humans do, so attempts to use them to find a vaccine didn't pan out.
They'll typically highlight that failure, you know, as a reason not to use chimpanzees in research.
Thomas Roll is a veterinarian by training, and he used to be responsible for all the chimpanzees at the University of Louisiana's Primate Research Center. He says research done with chimpanzees was invaluable.
There was a lot of information that was harvested, that was published, that people utilized as they've moved forward in both initiating therapies for HIV and ultimately for trying to produce a vaccine for HIV.
Researchers in the U.S. kept using chimpanzees long after most other countries had stopped. They made the most headway with hepatitis. Here's Thomas Roll again. He refers to chimpanzees as the model, as in animal model for humans.
During the 70s, Merck Pharmaceutical Company was developing a vaccine for hepatitis B. And that model was absolutely pivotal for that vaccine being developed. And it's still in use today.
The vaccine is, but chimpanzees aren't. Over the past couple of years, the National Institutes of Health has stopped providing federal dollars for chimp biomedical research because other options are available and because of ethical concerns. Meanwhile, the Department of Fish and Wildlife uplisted captive chimpanzees to endangered. So now, pretty much every research chimp in the country is eligible for retirement, and chimp sanctuaries are building more space as fast as they can. Thomas Rowell says he thinks the decision to stop using chimps in research is based on misconceptions about how animals are treated in research facilities. He says conditions have improved markedly over the past few decades. Thomas says he cares about animal welfare as well as human health.
When I was in just before high school, this is when Jane Goodall was working with National Geographic. And it came on with that music, you know. That's what stimulated me to get into research and work specifically with primates.
Back at the sanctuary, a 35-year-old male named Burrito is banging on an empty steel drum.
So that's Burrito displaying a little bit, pushing that barrel around.
Director Diana Goodrich says Burrito's telling the other chimps and the humans he owns this room. It's a big room to own. There are 15-foot ceilings and a loft so the chimps can climb and build nests and take naps up high. In the wild, chimpanzees spend much of their time in trees.
These 7 chimps that live here have been through a lot. I mean, they've experienced invasive medical testing. Their lives have been upended repeatedly. Every time they get familiar with one environment, they're taken out of it and put in another.
Sanctuary director J.B. Mulcahy says the females were bred over and over again. In the wild, a female chimp gives birth about once every 5 years. JB says it's pretty typical for chimpanzees in captivity to be bred every single year to give birth to the next generation of lab chimps.
Probably the most traumatic thing that any of them experience in their lives is either being taken from their mothers or having their children taken from them.
JB says in the sanctuary, the animals can start to heal.
Really, one of the main things is giving them some autonomy again. As much as we can do for them, it's there for them, and they can take advantage of it at their own pace.
The sanctuary costs about $500,000 a year to run, and JB and Diana are adding space to bring in 15 more chimps.
It's our responsibility to sort of create a better environment for them here. Some of these chimps are going to have 40 or 50 years left, and we can make those good years.
This story from Central Washington State was reported by Eilish O'Neill. We're talking about animals in labs, what they can teach us, and how we should treat them. A lot of researchers use tiny model organisms in their work.
Cheap, small, breeds easily. That has a lot of genetics available to it, so you can manipulate the genes, because that's really important.
That's Hugo Bellin. He's a geneticist at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And one of the model organisms he uses in his work are nematodes.
Tiny little worms. You can barely see them. They're crawling around in a dish, and you can cultivate thousands of them. And they sense their environment, and they eat these bacteria, and they control how fat they will become, and you can find genes that are very fat, you can find genes that are skinny, and you can then study these pathways that make these worms fat or skinny and study the basic biology behind it.
Another reason these worms are useful is that they only have 1,000 cells.
And people have been able to trace the entire lineage of the worms. So you can start at the single cell level, observe them under a scope, and watch the cells divide till the worm is formed from a single cell. People found that quite a few cells during development actually die off. And that was really important, because that means there is a program to control cell death. And that program is very important, because if that process goes wrong, you may get cancer.
Model organisms like worms or yeast work for a lot of research, but not all. It depends on what you want to study.
Some phenomena you have no choice, because they don't exist in these model organisms. So then you're drawn to do experiments in more sophisticated organisms, because the processes you're interested in may just not be present or exist.
So is the rule of thumb, you know, if it exists in the simpler species, go with the simpler species?
That's the smartest thing to do. That's not always what people do, but that's really the smartest thing to do. If you study a very, very basic cellular phenomena, you should study it in yeast. But if you study something that's really sophisticated and requires understanding, you know, brain functions that are pretty complex, you may want to turn to mouse, or in some cases to flies.
How do researchers decide which organism they're going to use for their research? Is there sort of a checklist one can go through?
Most people are drawn at some stage of their career to a model organism because they're interested in answering a specific question, and they then join a lab. And because it takes so much time and effort to control and learn all the different assets and weaknesses of each species, people usually tend to stick with the model organism that they pick in their PhD or their postdoc. It's not that easy to switch. Some people have switched, and some people have switched from flies to mice, and some have switched from worms to mice, or some have switched from mice to worms, but it's really rare.
That's geneticist Hugo Bellin. He is a professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. One of the small lab animals that's getting a lot of attention now is zebrafish. And research on these striped, cold-blooded vertebrates is advancing science on a neurological disorder that affects about 3 million Americans. Molly Siegel has more.
At the University of Calgary, it all starts here, in the basement of the School of Medicine.
Steamy in here.
Yes, so we keep it at 28, plus all of the water evaporates, and so it makes it humid. So the fish are originally from a river in India, and so they like it steamy.
Neuroscientist Deborah Karash shows me a room full of zebrafish tanks. These fish are like the ones you'd see at a pet shop aquarium, but the tanks in this room aren't colorful, and I don't see any of those little plastic plants. Just lots of humming filters and pipes everywhere to keep the water flowing. In each tank, there's a handful of tiny striped zebrafish. The full-grown adults are about an inch and a half long. There are thousands of them. Deborah's lab studies the brain and development. One of her projects is looking for new ways to treat neurological conditions, including childhood epilepsy. The drugs that are available now tamp down the communication between brain cells. But those medicines don't work for about 30% of kids. Zebrafish are the first step to finding drugs that do work.
You look at a zebrafish and you think it's swimming around in water and it has nothing to do with humans. But in fact, their brains develop very similar to humans. Much of their organ systems do. They have a chambered heart, they have pumping blood, they have neurons and most organs that we would have in a human body.
When these zebrafish are just days old, Deborah's team genetically modifies them to be epileptic.
This is our wet lab, where we conduct most of the research.
In the lab, Deborah opens up what looks to me like a mini fridge, but it's actually an incubator.
You can see there's a little zebrafish guy way at the bottom, the black dots. They're about the size of a tip of a pin.
So small.
So these are larvae zebrafish. They're about 5 days old. You know, if you give me a lot of latitude, they're roughly equivalent to a child.
And their resemblance to us on a genetic level?
You know, there's more commonality than there is dissimilarity.
That's child neurologist Zhang Rowe. He's a pediatrician and a researcher. Deborah's lab made the zebrafish with epilepsy, and Zhang's lab is testing drugs on them. He and Deborah wanted to find a treatment that would do something different. Imagine that each brain cell is a city, and if the energy grid is disrupted, power goes out, and most things won't work properly. The scientists are working to identify an epilepsy drug that maintains a stable flow of energy within each brain cell.
Kind of like, you know, saying the city with the energy grid is functioning optimally.
The researchers worked through a library of more than 900 medicines already approved to treat other conditions. When you're using mice, this is the trial and error stuff that can take years. Mice need about 3 weeks to give birth, and they only have about 8 to 10 babies at a time. But zebrafish can lay more than 200 eggs every week. They're also cheap and easy to store, so you can have a lot more zebrafish breeding at the same time. To find out how a speck of a fish can sub in for a mouse, I stopped by Zhang's lab, where Cesar Gravilovich shows me the setup.
To look into the microscope, and what you are going to see, it's the larva, and then you are going to notice an electrode that will go into the brain of this larva. So
there's a giant microscope and liquid running through a tube in between two glass slides. Sandwiched in between those slides is a live zebrafish larva modified to have epilepsy.
So if you can take a look here.
Oh, wow. The larva is maybe a millimeter long, but when I peer through the eyepiece of the microscope, I see it in detail. Two large black eyes, a see-through body, and a needle poking into its head. That's the electrode measuring electricity in its brain.
So we can see exactly where the electrode goes and where we need to stop so that we make sure that we are in the brain of this larva.
The electricity reading tells the researchers how often seizures happen and how bad they are. And testing the effects of hundreds of drugs on the fish, the scientists found one that worked. Neuroscientist Deborah Karash says the successful medicine is called vorinostat.
And so it's a drug that's currently being used for cancer, is the drug we found.
That medicine was the only one they had to test on mice, because they'd already ruled out the other drugs using zebrafish. Now, Zhang Rou says they're moving forward to test the drug in children.
For us to be brought to a point where we're actually beginning a clinical trial, that's 3 years, as opposed to 15 or more years. So it's a huge difference.
This story was reported by Molly Siegel. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Let's take a look at an even smaller creature that's doing important work in labs. It's a fly.
Drosophila melanogaster. They've got these bright red eyes, dark red, you know, beautiful garnet kind of colored eyes, and they have a body that's kind of a buff color, covered with different bristles.
Geneticist Stephanie Moore loves these flies. So much, she wrote a book about them, First in Fly, Drosophila Research and Biological Discovery. I've often wondered, you know, when I have bananas in my kitchen or a pineapple or melons, and suddenly there are these flies everywhere. Where do they come from? How do they get there?
They got there because there were eggs or other flies somewhere along the chain, like at the farm or hopping on as they traveled to your kitchen or coming in your window.
And they replicate really quickly.
Really quickly, yeah. So a female can lay hundreds of eggs in just a couple of days.
So one bad banana can mean my kitchen is going to be filled with flies really quickly.
You could think of it that way, or a whole lot of experiments, yes.
Right. So if I'm looking at your book, it seems like every time I see one of these flies, I should really be saying thank you.
You could see it that way. I like that take on things. Yeah, they've taught us an awful lot about fundamentals of biology, and now more than ever relevant to human disease.
How did scientists get started using this particular fly to study things?
So our field really maps that back to a researcher named T.H. Morgan, and he started using the fly to study the mechanisms of inheritance, so the very basic of genetics. And it was around the time that they had rediscovered Mendel's work and were trying to understand it at a new level. The fly researchers noticed wide-eyed flies and flies with bristles. They have hairs all over them, and they are in a very defined pattern, and you can find mutant flies. They look like they've gotten a shave, so they're called a stubble mutant fly, or the bristles are forked. So these were obvious things that could be tracked and counted over many generations. And that kind of, you know, big data of its time really had an influence on understanding mechanisms of inheritance.
When you study these flies, do you have to get them to mate with a specific other fly, or how does that work?
Yeah, we do. It's very easy to tell males from females. The females are a little bit bigger, slightly different coloration, and we definitely decide who they get to party with. So we go through and select females and then select males and then set them up in vials of food and, you know, wait the 2 weeks to see who comes out afterwards. And that's a very powerful, very straightforward, but very powerful method for doing genetic research and learning new things.
So what might I have in common with a fly? What are some similarities? Can you give me an example?
Some of the most striking are the behavioral things. They have an internal clock the way that we do. So this is the work that was recognized last year with Nobel Prize.
So they have circadian rhythms?
They do. They do, absolutely. So they don't close an eye. They don't have an eyelid to close, but they definitely calm down at night and are much more active, especially mid-morning, early morning. And so they have a 24-hour cycle of wakefulness and sleepiness the way that we do.
Even though they live such short lives?
You know, the short life thing, that is true. It's different across the insect group. Drosophila that we study in the lab, they can live 2 or 3 months. And so it's not a 24 hours and dead kind of thing like it is for some insects. So it's a nice window of time that lets us do, for example, things on aging. During that 2 or 3 months, they slow down and they get, you know, weaker in muscles, and, you know, they don't learn as easily when we put them through very basic, simple learning assays. So they're parallels to our own aging that can then be exploited in research.
So they can learn things?
They can, yeah. So one of the assays that folks use is to put an odor that they don't like together with a food that they do, and they can kind of unlearn their distaste for something, and you can test them later and see how they behave and compare the ones that had a kind of learning strategy and the ones that didn't, and you can see different behaviors resulting from what they've learned about associating a smell with a nutrient.
What do you hope the flies might unlock for us in this decade or the next decade?
Well, I think, you know, especially as someone who's working at a medical school, the hope is to alleviate human suffering, right? So that's the end goal of a lot of the research that fly researchers and others are doing, of course. And I think the fly does have real strong potential to be a platform for very rapidly and in large numbers testing a simple model and understanding more about diseases. That's proved true in the past. So there's some drugs that you can connect all the way back, cancer drugs, for example, where you can connect back to early studies of fly development in that case, where the things we learn what's going right, cancer they're going wrong, and then we can figure out what to target with a drug.
That's Stephanie Moore. She is a geneticist and lecturer at Harvard Medical School. Her book is First in Fly. Doing fly research has its challenges. Here's another scientist who uses flies in her lab.
Batuya Bayar-Magnai, and I work as a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Bioengineering at Temple University.
In order to study her flies, Batuya has to stop them from flying around. She places them on a pad underneath a microscope that emits low levels of CO2. She sedates them.
So one of my very first times I had my flies on the pad, I had suddenly had an urge to sneeze, and it didn't occur to me to look away enough that I completely sneezed all over my flies, and then they went all over the bench, and I was panicking. I was like running around before they wake up trying to collect them. And then, you know how you would collect breadcrumbs and stuff off the table when you're trying to clean after yourselves? With your palm, trying to collect everything into the palm. That's exactly what I did. And it was just shocking. I crushed some of them. And basically, I told my professor then, and they're like, it happens to all of us.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Mike Moscarelli is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.